Live from our nation's capital, it's the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Levine, reporting live from the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. Today, I'm going to have a very special guest in just a few minutes. His name is John Andrews. He's a former state senator from Colorado. And the reason I started to say conservative is because, well, he may be one of the most conservative guests I've ever had on my show. In fact, he hosts the second largest gathering of conservatives nationwide, the Western Conservative Summit, second only to CPAC, which many of you have heard of. Now, why would I host such a right-wing conservative on my show? Well, a couple reasons. One is he hosted me live at the Western Conservative Summit in Denver, where I attended in Denver live, me personally, not just my radio show. I actually flew to Denver and did a debate with Katie Pavlich of Fox News on the issue of guns, on whether or not we could have better gun safety regulation. And you can, by the way, find that debate, which I highly encourage you to watch, at marklevinetalk.com. Just listen after the show is done today. And you can hear our debate. And obviously, the audience was, although they disagreed with me, they were relatively polite. And John Andrews has been unfailingly polite to me. He hosted the debate fairly. He allowed both sides equal time. He timed them by the clock. And I think I did pretty well. Though, again, if you'll listen to it, you can let me know on a future show how you think I did. But I'm going to have him on the air for another reason, a broader reason, a more important reason. I firmly believe liberals and conservatives need to talk to each other. And need to talk to each other with respect as long as we're treated with respect. If you heard my show yesterday, you heard a really terrific caller from North Carolina who disagrees with me on abortion. I'm pro-choice, he's pro-life. And that's one of those issues, let's face it, that you're highly unlikely to persuade many people on. Right? We can talk about the ins and outs and technicalities of the Iranian nuclear deal and recognize that there are all kinds of subtleties, and you might be able to persuade someone on that one. But sometimes abortion, I think, goes down to a gut feeling, and he actually conceded, my caller, that much of his gut feeling comes from his religious background. And I'm not going to change someone's religion, or at least certainly not in a 20-minute conversation on radio. Although if you've heard my show long enough, you know we've had these conversions of conservatives on my show on perhaps issues of less emotional significance than abortion. But the point is, we had an agreeable discussion. In fact, the caller even agreed with my analogy, talking about the killing of animals and how I still eat meat, but I don't want to watch the killing of animals, to explain how it is that someone who's pro-choice looks at that Planned Parenthood video. It is a very pleasant exchange. And I know you know, if you call in my show and you are a conservative, that I firmly believe in a reasonable exchange of views. Now, you can cross the line. Not with what you say. Well, maybe with what you say. If you start insulting me all the time, it's like, well, that's just stupid. If there, I'm insulting you back. And I would do that if you insulted me personally. When you disagree with someone, you should always attack their views. You should say, I believe your view is irrational. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense to me because of this. Let me give you another fact. You shouldn't say, as Rush Limbaugh once famously said of me, Mark Levine is a blithering idiot. Well, you know, Rush Limbaugh is a blithering idiot. Let's just go down and call each other names and talk about our mothers as well. It doesn't engender thought. It doesn't add to the debate. In fact, usually when someone does an ad hominem attack, a personal attack, I just say, well, obviously you agree with my views because you can't attack my views. You can only attack me. So that's beyond the pale. John Andrews, I'm quite confident, will not do that. He won't go beyond the pale. And the other thing he won't do is hog the mic. I just finished an interview with Sean Hannity that you can hear later on today. It'll also be posted on my website, marklevinetalk.com. In that interview, Sean raises some decent questions about the Iranian nuclear deal, but he doesn't give me a chance to respond to them. And then he has a conservative come in, and they raise more questions. And at one point, Sean says, Mark, you didn't address this, you didn't address this, you didn't address this. He lists 25 things I didn't address. So I said, Sean, let me address your issues. And then he keeps talking. I said, Sean, you said 25 things I didn't address. Let me address your issues. He keeps talking, and he runs out the clock. And I don't get to address his 25 issues. So you can't tell someone on the other side, you didn't address my issues, and then not let them address your issues. I believe in letting people talk. I believe we can learn something about our own views as we discuss the other side's views. So I'm looking forward to having John Andrews on right after the break, and we're going to talk about where our liberal and conservative views come from. And I think you're going to hear a very interesting discussion. If you want to call in and join the discussion, just dial 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275, and we'll be right back right after this.
He's a Bible-quoting, Constitution-loving, flag-waving, red-blooded, liberal American. He's Mark Levin. Give him a call now at 888-488-MARK. That's 888-488-6275. Progressive, progressive, Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. My guest, former State Senator John Andrews, invited me to Denver to speak at the Western Conservative Summit, the second largest gathering of conservatives that occurs annually nationwide. He could not have been a more polite host. He gave me equal time with the conservative, and I'm going to give him certainly equal time today. One thing John Andrews and I agree on, and we don't agree on much, but we agree that liberals and conservatives need to talk with each other so that we understand each other. And it's interesting that he's a former state senator since I'm an upcoming state delegate. So he's worked in state government in Colorado, and I'm going to be a state delegate soon in Virginia. John Andrews, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Mark, I've so looked forward to talking with you and your listeners today. Thanks for having me.
Here's what I want to do today. Usually liberals and conservatives come on air and we talk about some specific issue that's in the news. I want to try to be a little broader today, a little more philosophical, and really try to understand where our views come from. One of my concerns about liberals and conservatives is we really don't understand each other. We live, sometimes I fear you live in red America, I live in blue America, and our Americas are like two separate nations. So one of the things I want to discuss today is kind of a little bit of background first, and I'll probably have to have you on back because we're not going to finish in half an hour. But, John, where do you get your conservative views? Where do you think they come from? They come from your family, your religion, your background. What do you think?
All of the above. And first of all, thanks for trying to dig deeper to help you and me think through where we're coming from, and maybe that'll model for listeners that it would be a fruitful exercise for all of us to undertake, because as much fun as the polemics are, just firing back and forth on the issues of the day, it is important, I think, to be a little more reflective about just exactly where does the lens come from through which I see the world, and why is it different than the lens you see through. In my case, raised in the Midwest by a family that took the Bible and America's founding documents as the core of the education that I and my brother and sisters received, largely in church-related independent schools. Mark, being the nephew of a Michigan state senator who went on to serve in Congress for a dozen years, being schooled at that particular private school in St. Louis, Missouri. It's called Principia School, with explicitly conservative outlook. In fact, the terms liberal and conservative really were not as common in everyday political dialogue in the 50s and 60s when I was getting my education. They began to be more so in the 60s, but living pretty comfortably, upper middle class, didn't have to worry where the next meal was coming from or anything close to that. Not living in a lavish style at all, but I could certainly plead guilty to having very little sense of what it's like for families that had to live hand to mouth, or where a single parent is raising the kids on his own or her own, or wow, I just got laid off from my job. Well, how do I get retrained? Is the economy leaving me behind?
John, let me drill down a little bit.
Bright kid, I heard about, but I didn't live them, and so one could, to the extent that I've just sketched it, say, all right, he's likely to say he's conservative because the America he lives in is working pretty well for him.
Okay, well, and that's so. Did you grow up in a town, a suburb, or a city? Just give me an idea. You said the Midwest.
I was born in small town America in southwest Michigan near Holland and Grand Rapids, a little farming town of 600 or 800
Now,
people.
I think that's important.
Age six, I moved to a nice neighborhood of St. Louis, Missouri, within one of America's larger cities, and then in due time we lived in the suburbs outside St. Louis. So
here's my question for you,
John.
I was formed
overall by the American wave of suburbia of
sure.
the baby boom generation, of whom I would be considered on the very leading edge of being born in 1944.
So you've obviously seen the incredible unrest in Ferguson, Missouri. You probably knew where that was before. I never heard of Ferguson until a year ago.
Interestingly, Mark, I was at a conference in Ferguson just 2 or 3 days before the horrible encounter between the police officer and young Michael Brown. And so, as it blew into the news, I could almost picture the very street where it occurred. I could certainly picture the pleasant looking but grim mood of the neighborhoods where opportunity is minimal and despair and dependency are high.
So here's my question, and by the way, you don't speak like most conservatives, and I mean that as a compliment. others may take that as an insult. I mean it as a compliment in that you speak the language of compassion. You speak the language of caring about people who are less fortunate than you.
And this is my Christian faith that enjoins this upon me.
I think so, too. And I actually have long argued to liberals that we should never be anti-Christianity. We can be anti-certain brands of Christianity. You know, if people proclaim the prosperity gospel and claim that Jesus doesn't love poor people, they don't understand Christianity. We can be against that. But in general, I think the Bible is a pretty, socialist document. I mean, it talks about caring about the poor constantly throughout the Old and the New Testament. I mean, I think you'd agree that's an ongoing theme there.
The Bible, I like to say, helps us wrestle out how do you balance love and truth, how do you balance law and liberty.
And certainly care for the poor, I don't think you dispute
it. By love, I mean, I don't just mean the abstraction.
Right. That taking people, care of people less fortunate.
For. I mean, what do you do about those families that I was referencing a moment ago, where the layoff has occurred, where the
exactly.
despair is high, where the sense of racial injustice is centuries long?
So when you grew up in suburban St. Louis, I think what you said, but I don't want to put words in your mouth. I think you said you didn't really have much contact with families who were less well off. Is that fair?
I had almost none.
Okay.
My mom and dad tried to help families that came across their path who were in need, including the African American family of a devoted housekeeper that my mom employed part time. Then when my dad started a summer camp in the high country of Colorado, 200 miles west of Denver, we lived then again in a small town, and people of all different economic circumstances live within a radius of a mile, and my folks, again, were very kind to the people who didn't have enough. But basically, I grew up in a bubble, for better or worse.
And I take it the bubble was not only a socioeconomic bubble, but a racial bubble. I would suspect that suburban St. Louis had
the woman that I'm
segregated.
Ethel Bailey.
Right.
She's probably the only black person that I knew. And boy, I remember when the character of our St. Louis neighborhood began to change, and houses were being sold to black families within blocks of me for the first time, and I was stuck up on the street at, how old was I, 13 or something, at dusk one day. It scared the daylights out of me. I didn't have any money to give the kid that was trying to shake me down for money, a black kid, but suddenly I'm seeing something that I'd only ever heard about before.
And really, you hadn't even had interaction much with people of different races,
other than an extent
of a housemaid, which is actually...
Where we are in America today, and it is really one of the things that makes me proud of America as a patriotic conservative and freedom advocate, Mark, is where we are in America today is that it's increasingly possible to encounter someone without immediately going to the file folder that says, I am talking to a black person, I am talking to a Latino person, Asian person, or, this is a disabled person. We have managed not for that to be much less central to our categories of relating to each other as Americans than we were 50, 60 years ago when I was a kid.
John, how would you define conservative, particularly as opposed to liberal? When you say you're a patriotic conservative, and I say I'm a patriotic liberal, but they know my views on this station, so that's why I'm mostly focusing on yours. I get patriotic. I know what that means. What does conservative mean in your mind? When you say I'm a conservative, what are the first thoughts that come to your mind when you say that?
I think that government is less likely to be the solution to social needs and economic needs than private voluntary endeavor in for-profit or non-profit initiatives. I think that government must be watched carefully because human beings are flawed, greedy, power-seeking, and that doesn't change when they put on the cloak of government authority. In fact, sometimes it gets worse. We need government. I'm not talking about anarchy at all. I just my default outlook as a conservative says we need limited government. We need government to do its job and stick to its job.
Now, this is interesting to me because
so important.
So when I ask you what a conservative means in your view, you immediately start talking about government. I didn't mention government. I just say conservative or liberal.
Right.
But your mind immediately went to government. And I should tell you that when as a liberal, my mind immediately goes to where you started talking, to people in need, to people who are struggling because of socioeconomic needs or because there's racial discrimination or because women have gender discrimination or sexual orientation discrimination or a kid sick and in need of care or health care or a homeless person needs shelter. My mind immediately goes to people in need when I say the word liberal, and your mind immediately goes to the harms of government. And I just think – I just want – just sort of throw
right.
that out there.
That's why there's a creative and ultimately beneficial tension that occurs in a free society like ours, where the point of view that says here are hurting people in need, people suffering injustice. What can be done for them? That position rubs up against my position that I didn't by any means finish sketching
right.
out for you, but which includes the sense of don't just think about what organized political power can do for people. Remember that it can also do things to people.
Absolutely,
so,
John. I got to take a break. Hold on. I got to take a break.
Liberal impulse is.
I got to take a break, John. Hold on. It's radio. I got a commercial coming up. I will give plenty of time to talk after the break. And I just want to say I am skeptical of government too, but I want to know if you're skeptical of free enterprise. We'll be right back after this.
The voice of reason in an unreasonable world, Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, talking with former State Senator John Andrews Jr. He is the founder of the Western Conservative Summit. We're having a fantastic, cordial discussion about liberal v. conservative. And here's what I find so fascinating. So when I asked former Senator Andrews what he thought of, the first thing he thought about when he talked about his what it means to be a conservative is his skepticism of government. But this same person, when he talked about growing up, talked about compassion for others. When you ask me, my first thing, when I think of what a liberal is, I think about compassion for others. I think about suffering people. But I'm telling John, I also have skepticism of government. So it sounds like we both have the two liberal and conservative mainstays, but we have sympathy already for the other's position. Boy, maybe if John Andrews and I could agree, we could change the world. John, welcome back to the show.
Well, delegate-elect, I guess they can't call you that because there is the formality of a general election.
That's
in November,
true.
Right?
That's true, but people are already calling me delegate, so whatever you want.
By the
you
way,
can just call me Mark.
Progress. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I treasure. I'm not a career public office guy, but I didn't care about climbing that ladder. But I so treasure the 6 years that I spent as a state senator in Colorado serving in the majority, then the minority, then the majority again, and had the honor to be the presiding officer of our state Senate. And the sense that in a state of, in my case, 5 million, there were 100 of us, 65 senators and 65 reps and 35 senators that were being stewards of the laws for the other 5 million. It just I never ceased to kind of pinch myself for the honor and the heavy responsibility. And I think when you are sworn in at the Capitol in Richmond and you begin serving in early next year, you're going to experience the same thing. And then the other thing we have in common is the great satisfaction of winning an election. And you had a 5-way primary, is that right?
I did. And a very competitive 5-way primary.
The coverage of it in the Washington Post about how you had to battle it out. And when we talk about the intersection between political abstractions and people and some of the very real and often painful or tragic circumstances of life, the horror that your family went through with losing your sister as you did, and the fact that I gather putting some of that out there very, very candidly for you helped the voters recognize that Levine was the guy.
Yeah, it did, and it wasn't easy for me to do that. And we could do a whole other show on that. I appreciate what you said. I really do. In fact, I think in some ways, John, and you should call me Mark. Forget the delegate stuff. But you and I are flip sides of the same coin, which is, I think, why we're intrigued by each other. Because both of us believe in cordial discussion. Both of us are patriotic. Both of us believe in both compassion and skepticism of government. I think you're focusing a bit more on the latter and me a bit more on the former.
Yeah, and it's really a question of the mix. And that's why before the break I said that America as a free society really benefits from a creative dynamic tension between what can government do to me? I need to be on the defensive. Then again, what might government do for me or do for my hurting neighbor? In which case, I'm going to take the risk of collecting some taxes and enacting some laws and some programs. And,
okay.
Those are the broad outlines within which we have to battle out politics. It's kind of like the broad outlines that were agreed between you and your debate opponent at our summit a month ago, Katie Pavlich of Fox News, where she says gun control on balance, we need less of it. You said, no, let's have more of it. But I love the constructiveness of that debate that I was honored to moderate.
It was a great debate, and I've already encouraged people to look at it. It's on my website, marklevinetalk.com. So, John, let's delve deeper here, because I think we're getting something here. Your first instinct is to be skeptical of government, though you recognize the need for compassion. My first instinct is compassion, though I recognize the need to be skeptical of government. Here's how I look at it. To me, the government is the moderator, as it were, much as you were a terrific moderator in our debate a few months ago. And it seems to me that the rule maker, as long as they have that the conservative principle, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that basically the government should make fair rules and they'll let everyone rise or fall as far as they want. Is that I don't want to put words in your mouth, but is that
but fair rules would include a safety net.
Okay, well, that's further than I've heard a lot of conservatives say.
Absolutely.
I'm really glad to hear you say that, a safety net to protect people from falling too far.
The cliche is safety net, yes. Hammock, no. And you see, then again, you get into questions of definition, questions of degree. Welfare reform in the mid-90s was vetoed twice by Clinton. It was handed back to him by Congress a third time, and the combination of some changes that were made and some political pressures that this Democratic president felt facing a Republican Congress, it gets signed. And the premise of it was, let's not have, under the guise of compassion, something that creates a dependency trap for people. Is it perfect? No, but it was an improvement.
All right. So let's safety net. Can we agree that everyone should have a roof over their head so they don't die out in the elements? Is that a fair basic minimum?
Okay. Yeah. Nobody should be going hungry, and nobody should want for basic medical care. I'll just move it along like
that. Wow. Okay. So I was just going to say those two: food, shelter. I only have four: food, shelter, medical care, and my fourth is in education, which you'll probably agree with me as well. Education is the only clear route out of poverty. And so if everyone has a chance to escape poverty, everyone should be able to get a decent education and let them escape poverty.
Mark, we agree. It's a mockery to say all created equal in our founding document, the Declaration of Independence, which to me is a secular sacred scripture, and then not provide somebody the tools to realize their God-given equality and their God-given talents just because of the circumstances of their birth.
So far we're in agreement. Let me take it one further. If the main goal of government is to provide fair rules, to let everyone play by, you know, weights and measures, right? The government defines what a meter is or a foot is, and everyone knows when they're selling what it is. It's just the referee, as it were. And you've included a safety net, which I really like and I really appreciate. But here's my problem with looking at it as a rules-based game. If you and I start the Monopoly game, and we got someone carefully being a referee and making sure that no one's robbing from the bank and everyone gets their payment for their rent and all of us get, you know, whatever the chance or community card says. The difference is you and I in a Monopoly game, John, we start with the exact same amount of money and we both start at go and we both roll the dice from the beginning and the highest roll goes first. We start right at the same starting line. And then when you start at the same starting line, obviously, if you've got a fair rules player, I am all for that game. I love games. I love to play games. The game I don't want to play is the Monopoly game where you start with $10,000 and I start with $100 and you put us both at go and say, let's say how far you go. Then you can have a very fair government, a very fair referee, making sure all the rules of the game are followed, but you're probably going to win and I'm probably going to lose because you started at the starting line with a lot more than I have. And that's, I say, the heart of why I'm a liberal and not a conservative, because we don't start in the same starting line.
Your analogy, I follow it. But the application, you lose me a little bit just in two ways. Number one, if all inequalities of material wealth and circumstance are in your mind subject to correction by government, then you and I have got significant disagreements there because that's real different from the safety net that I'm happy to try to provide and perfect if we can. And secondly, when you say one wins, the other loses, to me the analogy doesn't carry over, because what does it mean in the game of life to win or
okay,
or to
so
lose?
Let me take it out of
define that all day.
Let
we?
Me take it out of my Monopoly analogy and put it in real life. Okay, two kids.
Yeah.
Upper middle class white kid grows up with parents who are upper middle class. Wants for nothing, not just safety net wants, but has as many books as they want, maybe has a stay-at-home parent who has time to read with that child, who's well-educated, who knows, and that child gets all the health care. He's on a good shape on the path of life. Now, this girl, okay, she's also 2 years old. She's born to a single parent, an African-American parent, perhaps, who has to work three jobs and still barely can make means meet. She doesn't have books at home. Her mom can't afford them. Her mom doesn't have time to read to her. She's working all the time. And this child, and again, both are two-year-old children, and I think we can agree, you know, two-year-olds may make mistakes, but we can hardly blame them for much for their actions.
No.
These children are not starting at the same starting line. And to me, even with the safety net, my second two-year-old has food, shelter, healthcare, and education. She doesn't have the same chance to succeed. When I say succeed in the game of life, I mean get a good job to take care of her family and grow up to be an educated, supportive, productive American citizen. It's a lot harder for kid two than it is for kid one, and it's not the children's fault of their parents' circumstances.
So I don't disagree with anything you've said. Now comes the question of how do you design a helping hand for the less fortunate girl you just described and that is truly a helping hand, that that does not
lead to dependence,
end up being where you give aid to the mom and the mom is irresponsible and she squanders it, or you create, as I've referenced two or three times in this discussion, you create dependency and you undermine effort. And
okay.
I acknowledge that there are people for whom all the effort in the world will never overcome the lousy shake they got by no fault of their own, by an accident of birth. But we have to think about those things. Incentives motivate human beings. If government, in its effort to benefit people, or for that matter, private philanthropy in its effort to benefit people, undermines self-reliance, what Arthur Brooks calls earned success. If dependency is fostered, if there's a sense that the world owes me a living, if you get victim grievance mentality coming in, especially as it relates to race and ethnicity, then well-intentioned efforts may in fact make things worse. Could you acknowledge that?
Sure, but two responses. Sure, I acknowledge what you said. But I would say, first of all, the reason I talked about children, and the reason I talked about infants, in fact, was because I specifically wanted, in my hypothetical, two kids who haven't done anything wrong yet. I don't mind if you want to blame a 20-year-old for the consequences of his or her actions, but nobody really blames a 2-year-old for the consequences of his or her actions. And so that's why I brought up the child example. And when it comes to children, how about if we had in-kind aid? In other words, you're afraid of giving money to the kid's mother. All right. What about Head Start? What about we make sure that every kid gets preschool education?
Good idea in concept. The last time I checked, the research is fairly gloomy about Head Start ever really making a difference for kids.
No. There we're going to disagree. I'll tell you what. During the break, you run to your sources. I'll run to mine. I think I can show you that early education really, really helps kids. I think the studies show that. So we've hit our first somewhat disagreement. I want to encourage folks, if they want to call in and ask questions of John or me, to call in at 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. We'll be right back right after this.
He's a Harvard economist and a Yale lawyer. He does not keep up with the Kardashians. He's Mark Levine. Give him a call now at 888-488-MARK. That's 888-488-6275. Who says nerds can't be fun? It's Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. My guest is former State Senator John Andrews, who puts together the Western Conservative Summit every year. We're having a really great philosophical discussion about liberals and conservatives that, honestly, we ain't finishing in this hour. I'm just going to have Senator Andrews back to talk more about this. Right before the break, we talked a little bit about Head Start programs, and I just wanted to throw out what I found in my very quick Google search. There's research by David Deming of Harvard University, Jens Ludwig of University of Chicago, and Eliana Garces of UCLA, all showing that Head Start graduates are more likely to graduate from high school and attend college and get a job. They're more likely to have reduced child mortality. They're more likely to pay back to their society, that it costs less, in fact, because it's $90,000 to incarcerate a child and only $8,000 to pay for preschool. And the study that suggested that it petered out in third grade mentioned that there were many other things that didn't exist, such as books in the home, such as violence in the community, such as people living in poverty, that seemed to outweigh those other benefits. But what it tells you really is that Head Start's not a panacea. I'm not saying it is, but that it does really good things. It just doesn't complete the job. John.
Well, Mark, I know from watching you in action and the gun rights debate at the Western Conservative Summit a month ago that you're a statistics machine.
I am.
So I didn't attempt to Google any of this during the break. I just killed a few brain cells playing Angry Birds and listening to the whole music.
Well, see, now you got to stay on your toes. Let me ask you something else.
Just say thank you. Thanks for the intellectual honesty of acknowledging that there was that study, and I know that must be what had stuck in my mind. that when they get kids get past third grade, it's hard to tell if they ever did if they had a bump out of Head Start, because there are all these other factors. But that's not a reason to pull the plug on one particular program.
Exactly, because we're not going to solve all the poverty through Head Start, and I never made that claim.
No, marginally. But I'm going to go ahead and acknowledge that that you win this round. So let's go on having.
Fine.
Having Head Start.
Okay. So let me ask you, here's, I guess, the heart of what I hear whenever I talk with conservatives, particularly about issues of poverty, is they're constantly worried, you're constantly worried, about people abusing the program. And I will concede to you that there are cases. I happen to think they're very rare. You may think that they're more common than I think they are. There are cases where somebody takes someone else's food stamps, where somebody signs up two people in the program. There is fraud committed. I would dare say it's less than 1%, but whatever it is, there is fraud committed. Here's my concern, John. It always strikes me that conservatives really care about whether poor people are committing fraud, whether they're a culture of dependency, whether they're taking food stamps, which after all is like $4 to $6 a day per person. It's really hard to eat $4 to $6 a day, that kind of food. But they never seem concerned when Wall Street billionaires steal billions of dollars, often from taxpayers. And I guess my thought is this. If you steal $4...
I'm concerned about both.
I would say if you steal $4, that's bad.
A lot of the same Wall Streeters are donating more to your party than mine. Honestly, Mark.
Well, I don't think that's true. Although I'd like to get money out of politics, and we can have that discussion another day too.
Well, yeah, impossible. It's like getting oxygen out of air. It ain't gonna happen.
I can dream.
John. Let me say this about lifting people out of poverty. I got my eye on the clock.
Me too.
And we'll have to resume this. This has been a lot of fun.
I'd love it.
Probably the most effective move against human poverty in the history of the world has been the freeing of the Chinese economy over the last 30 years. And then if you take it to the domestic scale, you can make a good case that the most effective anti-poverty endeavor in America today is not all the government programs put together, a lot of them well-intended, and I've acknowledged that a lot of them are important and valid, but productive than all of that put together is the low prices that people have been given, not just through Walmart, but through the entire retailing revolution. And interestingly, that ties back to the freeing of the Chinese economy as well. You're going to find in me, by the way, another time, a free trader, not somebody that's too worried about trying to let goods and ideas and services move across the borders of the world. But I'm arguing, Mark, that government undertakings for the safety net, as important as they may be, are dwarfed by what private enterprise can do with human creativity to share wealth more equitably and abundantly.
So the way I see it is, I'm not a socialist. I don't believe in equal results, no matter how hard you try. I am a meritocrat. I believe in getting everyone as close to the same starting line as possible, giving every kid a chance to succeed everywhere, including poor kids, and then rise or fall. I'm all about merit. You know, if you work hard, you should succeed.
In the brief time remaining, I bet you have two or three agenda items that you hope to advance when you're a state legislator in that very realm. Is that right?
A lot more than two or three. John.
Well, give me the soundbite. What's your first bill you'll file or the first cause you'll take on when you're sworn in?
You know, probably to increase the minimum wage. So that's probably something that we're going to disagree on.
There's another great discussion for the future.
John, we only got like a minute left. I do want to get a caller in. I have no idea what the caller is going to say. Caller Mike from Memphis, you got only about 30 seconds to make your point.
Okay, I'm gonna make my point. Y'all having a good intellectual, conversation, but I think it's just all hobbies. I don't his views on conservatism I don't agree with, because when you look at it, when the government was working for white people back in, the early 19th century, it was all good. Now that equality, we're trying to make it equal for all people in America.
I got your point, Mike. I'm only rushing you off the phone because we only got a minute left. So, John, his point is the game was stacked unfairly. Blacks began as slaves. They started way behind the finish line, and now they're putting both and saying, go, do the best you can. When one person's been tied up and shackled for 100 years, that it's not really a fair game. Kind of goes back to my Monopoly game. You're not going to have a chance to respond only because we're out of time, but, John, Andrews, Senator John Andrews, you are welcome back anytime. We can do this next week.
Mark, have people come to WesternConservativeSummit.com and find out about our conference that you help with.
Fair enough. And seriously, we're going to have to do this again. We'll schedule something.
It was fun. Thanks a lot, Mark.
Thank you so much. Follow me on Twitter @MarkLevineTalk. This is Mark Levine signing off.